It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 574 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great conversation with Jeff Messer from Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll. Jeff is a 2019 Eisner Award-nominated writer for the Tomorrow's book, Mike Grell, Life is Drawing Without an Eraser. His new book, Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll, is now available on zoop.gg and is described this way. The continuing serialized adventures of the Hitman, Cowboy, and Gulag A-Go-Go are combined with new stories with new sex, new spies, and more rock and roll. New artists from around the world join the series regulars in these retro 1980s adventures, unfolding the wider tapestry of the sex, spies, and rock and roll universe of characters. We discuss how these two volumes came to be, what's included in these books, and what Jeff is up to that we will soon discover. These comics, of course, will help you return to the 1980s when the music was loud and the fashion was louder. I'm sure you'll enjoy what Jeff has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Jeff Douglas Messer, the creator of a fascinating series called Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll, which is on zoop.gg. And by the end of February, or around that time, your campaign will be done. So how's it going, Jeff?
It is going really, really great. I'm super excited to be here and talk with you, Wayne. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to talk with you because I'm always interested in spy stories. That's something I grew up as I was reading. Oh, and I highly recommend people get the chance to read your – in the first volume, there's a preface called From Childhood Dreams to Four Color Adventures,
yes.
Which I enjoyed reading, which was I resemble that remark.
Well, you know, you and I think we both grew up in, you know, the 70s, the 80s, you know, back in the day when, you know, James Bond was still a hot new thing, and creativity and comic books and, you know, all the distractions that, you know, here's the grouchy old man. These kids today have all these distractions, and we had our imaginations, and we had, you know, these things that inspired us. And one of the things for me, I was a kid growing up in farm country in rural North Carolina. And, you know, those ABC Sunday night movies with the James Bond movies just blew my mind and inspired me. And I was like, I want to be a storyteller. I want to tell these kind of stories and be creative. And so I started making up my own stuff, honestly. And you know, at that point, playing with Star Wars action figures, but you're renaming them as my characters and making them do, you know, secret agent stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really good. Well, that's kind of the fun thing. When I was a kid, I grew up like you. I didn't grow out in a far removed place, but where I grew up, there were nobody else that bought comics. It was just my brother and I. And we would buy comics, and everybody else would make fun of us because we bought comics. But then now what's the funniest part is there's a professional artist who works on comics that lives in my hometown.
Nice.
And I think revenge is
that's it. That's the perfect revenge, right? Living well is the best revenge. Yes. You know, for me, I was a senior in high school in 1989, and I had spent, you know, the better part of my school years, much like it sounds like you did, being tormented by the athletic kids or the popular kids or the whatever for being a comic book nerd, you know. And there were a handful of us in school, 2, 3, 4, you know, we'd find each other. And a funny thing happened my senior year, about halfway through the year, all of these jocks started showing up in February of 1989 wearing Batman t-shirts because they had heard of this little thing that was going on in the cinemas, you know. Batman fever hit really big. And for the first time, I felt like I had a little bit of power, you know, where I was like, hey, you guys are working my side of the street now. I politely ask you to take that somewhere else. But you're right. Now we're living in a world where that's the predominant popular culture is based around the things that we were shoved in lockers for when we were kids.
Well, I get a huge kick because I understand that in my hometown, there are people going around wearing t-shirts that have comic book characters on them. And if I had done that in the past, you're right, I would have been maimed for such things. But now, of course, and these are the jocks doing that. That's the part that really kills me.
Right.
They're really doing that. The other ones going out there, going to the Avengers movies and going to see Batman and stuff like that. And I'm always going, where were you guys when I was growing up? I would like to have had some help with that.
And I can tell you about all of those characters and where they came from.
That's right. Something you don't know anything about. That's
that is true. That there is a whole lot of comic book culture from people who would have not read the comic books these days, right. Which is you know, disheartening to a certain degree.
Yeah, but the thing of it is that, you know, we can't expect changes like that to happen in our lifetimes, although sometimes they do. And the good news is that we get to look back and say, aha, see, I knew that was going to happen.
I was a genius the whole time, something like that. But no, and I really, you know, as a kid, the comic books were, you know, that gateway for me. To sort of see and read. And I was reading science fiction and comic books, you know, a year, 2 years before I saw Star Wars in movie theaters. And
wow.
You know, when I saw that, it changed my world right then and there. Like, wow, you can do this? You're allowed to make up stories like this and people will respond to it in a positive manner. It was mind-blowing, but it was life-changing as well. And I knew right then and there, so I'm going to be a storyteller. I didn't realize that it would take all the way through until 2019 for it to actually finally happen.
Yeah, I got to tell you one quick story. I'm a Star Trek guy as opposed to Star Wars.
Okay.
I had they ran syndication, and one afternoon there was an episode in which these people got turned into cubes and crushed. And I could not sleep that night. And my mother said, you're not watching that show anymore. And so it wasn't until I got to college and they ran it in syndication where I was going to college that I actually got to sit and watch all these episodes. But my mom said, never again. You're not going to get to do that. But it's funny to me how these kind of things go. But so tell me, in a place like that, how did you get comic books where you lived?
It, you know, it's a funny thing. There was the typical American corner store, if you will, maybe about a mile from my house. I lived in, like I said, kind of a farming community near aunts and uncles and grandparents and all of that, you know, family, legacy, farming, all, you know, all that. And, you know, for whatever reason, my grandfather just one day came back from the corner store where he would go and spend hours, you know, probably getting away from my grandmother. He would go spend hours, you know, sitting on a stool and talking with all the guys, you know, so Norman Rockwell stereotypical that you could just choke on it. But it was true. You know, this is what it was. And I spent a lot of time as a kid with my grandparents. Both of my parents worked. And so I was kind of, you know, shuttled off to stay with the grandparents, which was like two doors down. So it was never a big problem. But one day my grandfather just comes home with a comic book and he picked it up from the store. And this was one of those stores where they just get a box every week off of the delivery truck that brings them their, you know, their seed and feed and their candy bars and their whatever else, deliveries, you know. And I just suddenly was like, oh, there's a whole rack of magazines and comic books in the corner of this store. And so from that point on, I saw it and it just kind of sort of captivated me. I had always been interested in, you know, stories and I was a big, you know, cartoon fan as we all were in the 70s and watching the Super Friends and the Batman stuff. Mm-hmm. Batman 66 was in syndication to that point. So I had this frame of reference And then once I connected to the comic books, you know, I would go to the store with him and just sit in the corner and just go through all of the books that were there and, you know, pick up a book here and there. And you know, it was off to the races from that point on. So it was years, gosh, you know, high school. By the time I was in high school, was the first time I knew that there was a comic book store 30 miles from my house in the big city, if you will, and, you know, went to try and find it. I just didn't realize that it existed. There was a point in middle school, early high school, where newsstand and direct sales really started being a thing. And I was a Legion of Superheroes fan in the comics, and they went to a they were one of the first books to go, hey, we're going to do a direct sales only book.
Right.
And it was crushing to me because I'm like, how in the world am I going to get this? I actually subscribed to it for several years. I got comics in the mailbox, you know, in a very flimsy bag with a very flimsy board, mind you. And I still have all of those, but I was so determined. I'm like, I'm going to write a money order for that $9 a year for 12 issues. And by golly, I'm going to keep up with this title. And, you know, where there's a will, there's a way kind of thing. And it taught me so much about storytelling and writing. And I, you know, fancied myself as a kid a little bit of an artist. But then by the sixth grade, there was a kid that moved to town and moved to the school. And he was brilliant as an artist. So I'm like, I'm going to give that up and I'm just going to be a writer. And so, you know, the die was sort of cast at that point. But it was pure escapism into my own imagination at a certain point.
See, I'm kind of curious, though. How did you make the jump to, like, with watching movies about spies to actually writing a comic about them?
Well, you know, it started out, I wanted to be like Ian Fleming, and I wanted to write. I had these characters I created. My cousin, who lived next door, he and I would, you know, I would use him as a sounding board. He and I would talk about these things, and he would help me with ideas for characters and stuff. And then I would go and I would write it down. And, you know, I'll kind of take it back to Star Wars for just a sec. When I saw Star Wars for the first time, I mean, it really was a transformative thing for me. And, you know, I was seven years old. So I was the target audience and saw it at a drive-in movie theater with my uncle and my aforementioned cousin, Mike. And when I went home from that experience, it really stayed with me. I mean, there were trading cards and there were, you know, the picture storybooks that you could get from the book club at school. And there were things around the movie. But at that point in time, and people forget this, in, you know, the 70s and even into the 80s, when you saw a movie in movie theaters, you had no realistic expectation that you would see it ever again.
Right.
There was no home video. There was no way that you could keep it, that you could own this experience and revisit it over and over again.
Right.
And the first thing that I did the next day after seeing Star Wars, and for about a week afterwards, is I got a stack of notebook paper, and I adapted the entire thing from my seven-year-old memory into a junior novelization, and that's being very kind to call it that. But I wanted to hold on to the experience, and the only way I could think of doing it was to write it down, to make notes of it. And I did little illustrations at the bottom of each page just to kind of, you know, depict what was going on that page. I still have it and several others that I did as a kid, and you know, it's only slightly embarrassing to look back on, but but that was the thing that kind of lit the fuse. And I ran with that for several years. I did my own little adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and Battlestar Galactica and, you know, and all of these things that just were in that wheelhouse. But by the time I was 11 or 12, you know, when I was 10, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, blew me away. Like, whoa, this is next level. Enough of that silly space stuff. I'm into the real world now, you know. And archaeology and action adventure and stuff. So I kind of started moving in that direction. And then I saw one of the either Sean Connery or Roger Moore James Bond movies on the Sunday night movie. And it was like, whoa, this is awesome. Spies are cool. And so I shifted from science fiction, science fantasy, right into spies as a result. And, you know, at that point, I thought, oh, I'm going to create my own characters. I'm going to write novels. And I plotted out a series of 7 novels that were standalone, but all linked together for the final novel where everything comes together and so forth. And I just worked on it just relentlessly as a kid, all through high school, middle school even. I would go walk from my junior high 6 blocks to take piano lessons when I was in the 7th grade. And I had to wait an hour and a half for my time. But it was the only way I could do it. My parents were working. And so I was like, oh, I'm just going to go sit in this living room for an hour and a half. And I would bring notebooks and I would write. I would write, write, write. And at school, I looked like the most studious person there because the teacher's like, man, he's writing every word I'm saying. He said, no, I was writing my novels. I was writing stories in class. And it just made me look very studious. And I tried that. And I did several of those early ideas into novels. And, you know, graduated high school, kind of moved on, discovered theater, realized that playwriting is a lot easier than novel writing because you don't have to describe things, right, you know, into great detail. Right. And so I worked in theater for, you know, most of the 1990s and when I was in my 20s and going to college and everything. And I started writing plays, which is all very dialogue-based. And tried to go back to pick up the novel in the mid-90s and stalled out at some point. And, you know, then, you know, had a kid, got married in the early 2000s, blah, blah, blah. All those things that happen to you that life just sort of takes over.
Life gets in the way of comics.
Life gets in the way of comics. And, you know, it was a few years ago in the beginning of the pandemic, and I had sort of started getting into wanting to work in and around comics in some way, shape, or form. I became friends with a creator, artist, writer, Mike Grell, and I'd helped him with some projects. And I got asked to co-write a book about him, about his career, because he and I had become friends. And then the book got nominated for an Eisner Award in 2019.
Wow, congrats.
And, you know, here I am. I'm 48 years old going to the Eisners. And I'm like, I feel like there's a page turning in my life right now. It's really weird, you know. Is this a message being sent to me that this is what my path should now be? I wanted it 25 years ago so bad I could just taste it. Didn't happen, moved on. Now it was being presented to me again, this open door. And then the pandemic hit, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to spend all this quality time by myself, you know, locked up with my family, and I'm going to try it. I'm going to give it a try. And I had worked on adapting a version of Robin Hood that had been a play that I had co-written with someone, and we wanted to do it as a comic. And so we found an artist, and we were working on that when the pandemic hit. And we decided to just kind of keep going. And I thought, let me pull this old spy thing out of the drawer. You know, my son, who at that point was a junior in high school during the pandemic, and we were having those conversations. Hey, you know, when this thing's over and you're graduating high school and going to college, what are you going to do? What do you want to do? And he's like, well, you know, I want to work in film. And I thought, well, where did that come from? And he goes, well, I've written a screenplay. And I'm like, what you did? What? not thinking that he had not told me, because of course, you know, I was a writer, and I'm sure it was intimidating to him to want to share something with me. And I was like, get out, you know, come on, send it to me. So he sent it to me, and I started reading it, and I was just like, oh my God, this is the same. And I say this in the politest way, this is the same, you know, action adventure filtered through a high schooler's brain crap that I was writing when I was his age. And it was glorious. It was so fun to kind of see it. And I had been toying with the idea of my own, bringing back my own spy stuff. And when he presented this to me and I saw what he was doing, I thought, well, man, this is another sign that I should do this. And so I found an artist, and I thought, okay, and just the off chance, I'm going to send this artist some script pages, some character descriptions, have him do some stuff for me. And if it comes back and it looks like it might work, then I'll think about it. And so I sent him the character stuff, and, you know, a week later, he sends me 6 character designs. And I open up the file in the email and I look at it, and immediately I'm like, oh my God, these are my characters. He totally nailed it. He sold me on the idea that it would work. The artist did. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I've got to try it. So I got him to working on pages. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to take my son's, the first scene of my son's screenplay, and I'm going to send it to another artist and have him do like a backup story in this. And we'll do it as a Kickstarter, because I was starting to do Kickstarters at that point. And, you know, it seemed like an easy idea. And by the time we got from there to the actual Kickstarter, this thing had sort of picked up speed of its own in this weird, weird way. And other artists who were seeing some of the pages and some of the work were saying, can I do something with you? I'd like to, you know, get involved, and found another story and another story. And I thought, oh, wait, it's not a lead feature with a backup story. It's an anthology book. And this thing grew from, 30 pages to 120 pages in the span of a year. And I had multiple artists, multiple backup stories. And when I did the Kickstarter, people were like, this looks so fun. This looks so cool. It's retro 80s, which is when it was originally set. And I thought, I'm going to hold on to that, because the music, the fashion, the spies in the 80s were much more fun than the high-tech world now, because it's more physical and you got gadgets to get you out of things. But now everything is like, infrared radar and all of this stuff. I was like, no, let's make it more, old school spy. Mm-hmm. And the rock and roll thing was there. And I just thought, well, I have to come up with a title for this as an anthology. And I said, well, I'm thinking, what makes this work? What encapsulates this concept? The 80s and spies and rock and roll. And I went, oh my gosh, sex, spies, and rock and roll. Boom. And that was it. And it's been off to the races ever since. And every time I do it, it gets more and more popular, because I think people see how much just ridiculous fun it is. And I've fixed the scripts, by the way. I'm not translating direct from when I was in high school. I'm actually updating them in a lot of ways. And I kind of pigeonholed myself, because putting the word sex in the title, I was like, well, my idea of what was sexy when I was 14 versus now was a totally different thing. So I'm going to have to give that an upgrade. But it's been this wonderful rebirth of something that I thought I had just left behind as a relic of my youth. And now it's back, and it's kind of my driving creative thing right now.
See, that's the thing that's changed that people don't realize, is that there are people who can go to printing presses and can go you can use your computer to design and lay out things and stuff like that. Because one of the things I actually do is my roommate came up with the indie book, and I'm his editor. I edit his stuff. And originally it was a poem, but over time it became a comic. And of course he was a big comics fan, but now, like with you, when it comes to reading, he doesn't have time to read. He's too busy making stuff.
Right. Right.
And so he is, I'll never forget, because I had to share experience of similar to yours. He was looking for an artist, and he sent off a couple of basics, who these were, to people. And some of the stuff came back and it was junk. I mean, we were looking at that. Yeah. And then
there is some of that out there. I feel the pain, because I had to sift through a lot of that myself. And I was very picky, and I'm glad I was.
Well, we got one back. The bad guy. He drew the bad guy, and I looked at it and said, holy mackerel. I said, this is it. This is fantastic. And he ended up, he has ended up drawing the first 12 issues.
Oh, wow.
He's probably going to end up, he's probably going to move on to a different artist, because the girl is like 12 years old, or 7 in the first. And she's going to be more like high school age in the second, and the art style won't quite fit the high school stuff. So
right. Now, and I'm kind of in the same thing. I wound up with all of these different artists who are all very good, different styles, but all kind of work within the context of what I was doing. And several of them, I'm now trying to figure out ways. It's like, oh, I need to do more with this person. And that inspires me creatively too. So I've done all these spinoff books from the series, because one artist that did a 6-page story for me in the first book, so great, so easy to work with. His art, I just fell in love with. I'll send him something, and the next day he sends me a prelim layout to approve, and then the day after that he sends me a finished page. And I'm like, good Lord, this is phenomenal. And so, you know, he and I have already written and drawn 2 issues beyond where we are now. In fact, neither of the 2 issues that are in the kind of in the can are part of the current Kickstarter. These are for the next one and the next one and the next one, you know, further down. And it's just because I just really love working with this guy. Miguel Guzman is his name. He's an artist out of Mexico, and we just click, and I'll send him something and he gets it. And it's just boom. You know, when you capture that lightning in a bottle, it's hard to stop.
Oh, yeah.
I have to stop sometimes because I go, well, all right, my bank account, I need to wait another month or start another Kickstarter in order to, you know, to replenish the bank account to keep it going. But it inspires me to do that. And I was never one of those people. I don't know about you, but, you know, 10 years ago, you talked about the technology, and I think that's so important. The technology didn't exist 10, 15 years ago for me to have done this. When I wanted to do it back in the late 80s and the early 90s, it was virtually impossible to find an artist to have. We didn't have this internet sort of World Wide Web to connect with people. And the ease of it now, it has enabled me to be able to fulfill those dreams from before. So I'm very careful to kind of say I have no regrets that I didn't succeed 30 years ago when I was really desperate for it, because it wouldn't have worked back then, but it works now. And you know, now was when it was supposed to happen, you know, to be kind of fatalistic, I guess. But I'm kind of glad, you know, the pieces fell in place so that it's like, you know, now I'm in my early 50s and having a freaking renaissance. And I never expected that to come along. And it's keeping me young, I suppose.
It's super cool. You mentioned something that I really feel badly about, was that crowdfunding wasn't around until just a few years ago. And I always worry about what stories did we lose out on because crowdfunding wasn't there to help them happen.
Oh, yeah. I can only imagine. You know, I went to Comic-Cons in the 80s when they were, you know, tiny hotel ballrooms with sweaty dudes and long boxes and a handful of artists. In fact, true story, and I talk about this in some of the prefaces in some of the books. In the late 80s, I met and hung out with Adam Hughes quite a bit because nobody knew who he was. And I had seen this is early in his career. Like, he had done a black and white independent book called Death Hawk. And then he did Comico's Maze Agency with Mike Barr. Mm. And there were only 2 or 3 issues of that book out. And you know, back in the 80s, what we were talking about with things that would have been lost, there were a lot of these little independent companies that popped up that tried.
Right.
To do that very thing. And some of them were great and some of them weren't. Some of them failed, you know, went into the dustbins of history, but their intentions were great. But I remember taking the first chapter of my spy novel to Adam Hughes at one of these conventions and saying, hey, I like your art. I'm thinking about turning this into a comic book. Would you take a look at it? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. Literally within the 2 months between then and the next convention that I saw him at in Atlanta, he got the Justice League of America book at DC. And the next year I saw him back at Heroes Con in Charlotte. And I was just like, I'm so happy for you, man. I really, really am. And he'd kind of totally forgotten. Obviously, he'd forgotten that I'd given him this thing. And, you know, the funny thing is that, like, last year I ran into – or last year – time is so screwed up because of the pandemic. In 2020, right before the pandemic, there he was at a mini-con. And I went up to talk to him, and I said, you know, hey, you know, I'm a ghost from your past. He's like, uh-oh, what? And so I told him, I was like, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this this thing. I think I'm going to pull it out of mothballs and do it. And then I messaged him on his website last year saying, hey, I did it. And it's been a huge success. And here's a link and all this stuff. And so, you know, it was kind of nice to kind of circle back to that. But yeah, I mean, you know, to kind of bring it around to that point, you know, you had to, like artists back in the day, they had to go to conventions with their portfolios and lug them around and go, please look at my work. Please hire me to draw comics. It's even harder for writers.
Yes.
To do it because you're like, I have a really good idea. And it's like, well, good for you. But now the internet and the technology have become the leveling agent where anyone can do it. And I really encourage people. I've been to conventions and I've done panels and I've talked with people about it. And I'm like, look, you don't need a lot of money. If you want to do your comic, you can do it and print 10 copies. And if doing it is the most important thing and it doesn't matter that it's a success or a huge success or whatever, you should still do it. And if you do it and your passion kind of shines through, you don't know what will happen next. Absolutely. Maybe you sell 20 copies in your first Kickstarter and you go, I didn't lose any money. I didn't make any money. And then you do another one and you sell 100 copies. Mm-hmm. And your next one, you sell 150. And so, and it just grows like that. It's an exponential thing. And I think people now recognize other people's passions and want to reward people who are taking that risk, who are willing to put themselves out there. And that's how I feel when I back Kickstarters and other projects. I look at it and I go, I want to see this succeed because I want that person to succeed. I want to see them fulfill this dream. And you can tell sometimes, you probably have seen these too, where you look at it and go, yeah, they're not really being creative. They're trying to make a buck off of, you know, naughty covers and whatnot and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And I, you know, and I say that, you know, half jokingly, because with Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll, I'm like, you know how I'm going to sell this?
Right.
Is I'm going to do the covers as kind of pinup-y looking covers. I'm going to, you know, lead with the idea of, oh, this is going to be a sexy, sexy book. But my goal is that the people who buy those other books that are mostly garbage and just have dirty pictures in them are going to buy my book and they're going to start reading it and go, dude, this guy is actually putting something into this. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of those others are just lazy, you know, TNA books. And I want them to, you know, the people who buy those to maybe buy one of mine thinking, oh, this is another one of those. And they get it and go, I actually enjoyed that. Yeah. So that's my goal, is to, you know, sort of be entertaining, but to play their game a little bit too, as far as appealing, you know, to the baser instincts of some of the people out there. Because there's a lot of that. You've probably seen it on the Kickstarters and the Indiegogos and stuff like that. You know, the sex sells sort of thing. And I'm like, yeah, mm-hmm. sex does sell. But I'm going to do a story that, you know, is going to be, you know, sexy to a certain degree, but it's also going to be a legit story with characters and all that stuff going on. So, you know.
Because my roommate and I were at a convention, and the guy next to us had this massive display. And you're right, it was the lead character was female, and she had two outstanding characteristics. As I would say. And he was selling like crazy. I mean, these guys would come in, be long lines buying this stuff, and we were selling okay. You know, we weren't doing his kind of stuff, but I got a huge kick out of that. Now I see his stuff around. I don't see it sell quite as much.
Well, and I don't think there's no shelf life to that. I mean, you know, people will buy one or two of those books, and I have on Kickstarter. I've bought books going, oh, or the this looks like a sexy pirate book, and then I'll get it and read it, and I go, oh, this is garbage, and so I don't go back for the second issue. I'm not a repeat customer, you know, and I think that's the trap you fall into. Right. And I know when I had my main artist do the first cover, I had an idea. It's like, oh, you know, sexy girl laying on a floor listening to records with a pistol and a knife on her hip. So it's like sex, spies, rock and roll. Everything that it says, it's like a Campbell's soup can. When you read the back, the FDA says that you have to list the ingredients in order of most prominent. So I'm like, I want the cover to be sex, spies, and rock and roll. So I picked out a bunch of album covers. I'm like, all right, put those on the cover, put her on the cover and all this stuff. And as soon as he drew it, he sent it to me and I was just like, oh my God, this is so just spot on. Perfect. I posted it online and I was flooded with people who were like, what is this and how do I get a t-shirt of it? And I literally had people, and I was like, oh, I didn't think about making t-shirts. And I offered t-shirts, and people were like, I want a t-shirt of that. Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll, that's so perfect. And, you know, with 80s album covers on the front, you know, the Police and the Pretenders and Phil Collins and Madonna and all that stuff. And people just, I don't know, there was something about it that just attracted the attention. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a fine art to the cover that entices people. You know, you got to lure them in with the cover, but then what's under the cover has to sustain, you know, has to keep them. And some of those other guys that do those books, I just don't think they can sustain the audience.
Nope. I agree with you. Now, I do want to get into the book some.
Okay.
Because I'm interested in the characters, like talk about who are the main characters that if you buy like volume one, volume two, and hopefully in volume three, who are the characters largely that you're going to encounter in Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll?
The main characters, where it all started from, again, the teenage imagination is the original concept of my spy novels was three brothers. One of them's a spy. They come from a wealthy background, well-heeled background. Mm-hmm. One of them's a spy. One of them is ex-army. And the other one is a trust fund playboy who drives fast cars and tries to become a rock and roll star. And that was the original concept. So it's three brothers. The two brothers become suspicious of the one who's the spy and start digging too much. They uncover something. They find out a little too much, and they get targeted for assassination because of it, and he has to save them and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to give too much away, but you know, that was the basic original concept. And of course, you know, these are, you know, it's a teenage boy who's thinking is like, oh, you know, cool. What if I were a cool spy and I had a sexy girlfriend, and what would she be like, and did it, and all this stuff, all this, you know, fantasy fulfillment kind of nonsense that goes on in your mind. And, when I started putting it together as a story, it was just originally in the comic form going to be adapting, modernizing that storyline. Then ideas came to me for some other side stories. Support characters suddenly became more interesting. I did a thing in Kickstarter, which to me at the beginning, I thought this is such a risk and it sounds crazy and I could be putting myself in a horrible position. But I offered to let certain backers be depicted as characters in the story.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, this is going to be great, but also it creates a problem. If I have to find, how do I find roles for them? And is it sort of defying true creativity if I'm just forcing these characters into the situation? So I limited it to a small number. Mm-hmm. And, a buddy of mine who had read those stories back in high school when I was writing them got wind of me doing this and sort of was watching it. And I put this thing up and I was like, you know, you can be a character in the story. And he pledged it. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, my old buddy wants to be a character. So I emailed him and I'm like, hey, thanks. Appreciate you doing that. But what do you think? What kind of character do you want to be? And he goes, oh, I want to be, you know, some bad, you know, KGB, you know, assassin kind of guy. I'm like, okay, I got you. And so I mulled it over for a bit. And there's the one character, the main villain is, and this is so totally 80s. He was like a KGB agent who gets caught in an explosion and has body parts replaced with robotic and computerized body parts. And so he's like half man, half robot. Mm-hmm. So he has like all these things built into his arm, like his index finger can become a barrel of a gun and things pop out and he has weapons and all this sort of stuff. And so, you know, it's like just completely ridiculous, but fun. And I was like, oh, you know, this guy's a rogue KGB agent. I'm going to create a character which sort of existed in my original novel back in the day in one scene only. Is the guy who comes and drags him away to keep him from doing too much damage. Mm-hmm. A handler, if you will. And I was like, ooh, that's it. I'll make my buddy the handler. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I sent him the page once it was drawn. And he was like, this is really cool. And he was a writer too. And I looked up to him when I was in high school, a little older than me. And he approached me sometime well into the process and said, what if I write a story? And I was like, yeah, what if you write a story? You know, it's do that. It's say, take your character and you know, fill in some background. And so in the second volume, he has a story that he wrote. And I was like, oh, this is great. My son has a story in the book. My friend, former mentor, has a story in the book. And it's all kind of derivative in the same universe of characters. And my son's story is more contemporary. And I thought, and how do I make this fit with the 80s thing? It made me creatively figure out a solution of how to build this generation connection. So it's like the main stories are set in the 1980s, but I did a story that went backwards to some other previous spy characters. And I went did a story that went forward in time from the mid 80s. And I was like, I can tell a story that covers like a 40-year span from the 60s until the, you know, the 2020s or 2010s, if my math is correct. and base it around this core of these characters I created when I was a kid, these brothers, one of whom is a spy. And his girlfriend and his best friend are spies too. And back in the day, the story I created was, how did his best friend and his girlfriend become a spy? Well, it was her, actually. Her father was a spy, and they, on spring break in college, snooped and found out too much, and he had to bring them in to protect them. And she's the girl on the cover and all of this stuff. And then it dawned on me, maybe she's the star. Maybe it's not the brothers, but she's the star, and the brothers are just this one story. But the anthology book is about this network of spies, this International Security Foundation is what it's called, where they're worldwide spies. And so I started coming up with other story ideas and featuring her as kind of the one that I don't want to say Forrest Gump, but everybody gets the reference. She's the one that kind of appears throughout the most stories. She's the glue to hold the whole thing together. And as soon as that happened, it was like, poof, the light bulb went off. And so this went from, you know, being just a simple, you know, dude telling spy stories to the main character is this young female. And I thought, where did that come from? And it made it better. It made it so much better. And out of all of these weird things getting thrown at me, you know, the backers who were like, hey, I want to be drawn as a character. And I would look at, you know, these people that I would send me pictures and I would go, all right, you're going to be this spy and this is how you tie to this story and all this. And they're loving it. The people who are doing it love it. And it's like, I tell them, if your character is something that creatively sticks with me and takes off, you may appear all over the place. You may appear in other stories down the road. So I build this network of characters, and the more things that get thrown at me, the bigger the universe gets. And so it's this, it's gone from this tiny thing to this giant tapestry in a matter of like 2.5 years.
Wow.
And I've never felt so creative because of it. And because it's constantly solving problems as to how to connect all these stories, how to make it. Because you have to come up with the plots. It's like, how does this connect to this? This character in my son's story, who is he to these people from 30 years ago? And how is that going to connect so that 10 years from now, when I've run out of gas and people read this whole thing and they look back at it and go, holy crap, that all connects in this weird way. So it's one complete story. I don't quite know how I'm going to get there, but it's always the destination, not the destination, but the trip, right? The journey, not the destination. That's the saying. Right. And like I said, it's been the most creative of my life, you know, and I've been writing plays and doing other things for decades, but this is bringing out all of the best, you know, in me. And the more I do it, and this is the funny thing, is the more I do it, the more it gets kind of seen through social media. And again, the things that didn't exist 20 years ago that are helping this work now, I post things on social media. Other artists will reach out to me and go, hey, I've been watching this project that you're doing. Is there a story for me? Here's my samples. Here's my stuff. And literally, you know, I had artists who were going, let me audition for you. Let me do a couple of pages. Throw something at me and let me do a couple of pages.
Wow.
And the idea is that it's fun. I think people see it and sort of understand that it's fun. And the people who are involved with it The artist, the colorist, the letterer that I work with, everybody that's involved with it are kind of like, you know what? This is the most fun I have doing this, is working on the stuff that you send me, because there's wow. so much variety. It's so creative. It's so kind of over the top and crazy at times. But I think they sort of see what I always saw in it, in me, but never had enough faith to sort of believe that it would have that appeal. And now, you know, it's very humbling at the same time, you know, very gratifying to sort of see it all come together and all work like that. But I know you can't tell that I'm really just like always kind of hyper about it, because the ideas keep flowing. You know, I go to bed at night thinking about, all right, what's the next story in this character's life, or how does this connect to that? And it's constantly plotting. I live in a fictional world in my head, and I'm loving every minute of it, because the real world sometimes not so much fun.
That's right. Not so great. Let me tell you a quick story or two, and then I'll do a couple other things real quick before I let you go. There was a guy I knew. He was writing a comic, and one of his friends said, "Oh, you're going to do a comic? Put me in it." And so he did. And so what the guy didn't know was that he was not going to survive the issue. And so he has the book is printed and all that stuff. He gives it to the guy. The guy starts to read it, and all of a sudden his jaw drops open. He says, "You killed me." And he didn't make it past the first issue. I thought that was always a funny thing, because people expect, like what you're going through, sometimes they will last and last and last, but he didn't make it only a couple of pages and he was gone. So that was a funny bit.
Well, one of the first plays I wrote, real quick story, had a group of friends and involved in the theater, and you know, we were very close and very tight, and people sort of started to move away. And so I was like, "Oh, I'm going to write a play that addresses that emotional connection." Very Big Chill-ish, if you will. Kind of, you know, people know the movie The Big Chill. The repercussions of growing apart and then trying to come back together. And so I wrote this play called 5 Years Later, and it's about friends who reunite because of a death. And so I told all my friends, "I'm writing this play, and it's about us." And I had one friend who was like, "This is a horrible idea. Don't you do it. You're making the biggest mistake of your life. Do not do it. Do not do it. Do not." And I was like, come on. It'll be fun. Everybody will have a sense of humor. And she's like, nope. People are going to take it personally. People are going to get pissed. People are going to, you don't do it. Don't do it. So I didn't include her in the play. And then when I finished it and everybody read it, she was mad at me because she wasn't in it.
Where am I? Why am I not here?
Am I not important enough for you to put in this? I was like, oh my God, I can't win for losing in this. So yeah, so that story just reminded me of that experience.
That's funny. That's great stuff. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you about real quick, though, is the anthology aspect of it. Because, you know, yes. DC and Marvel and those people don't do anthologies very much. But you, I've noticed that indie comics and stuff like what you're doing, it really thrives and grows. And so I'm just, I was just interested, what was it that made you decide to go with anthology formatting?
Well, you know, like I said, there were ideas that sort of kept coming. And then once I started that first Kickstarter campaign, when I introduced the idea of, hey, you can be drawn into the book as a character, I think I only included a handful of those as options, because I only had a handful of characters that I could think of that I could put people into. And immediately, like all of those pledge levels sold out. And I thought, oh my gosh, people really dig that. And so I added another, because you can add another pledge level, you know, the return of having you drawn as a spy. And here's 5 more. Boom, they sold out instantly. It was like within 24 hours. And I was like, oh, dare I do it again? And I was like, you as a spy rides again, you know, part 3, whatever. And I ended up with like 15 or 16 people.
Wow.
That I had to find roles for. And I had other story ideas kind of floating around in my head that weren't necessarily connected to the spy universe. But at that point, my story and my son's story weren't connected either. I didn't think about connecting them. And so I was like, oh, you know, I had this one story that I wrote for a creative writing class back in college that was kind of a short story about a hitman and an FBI informant and blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, it could still be a hitman, but I can make him like a KGB agent that's under protection and all of this stuff. And so I did that. It was a 6-page story. I adapted it. And then retroactively later, I looked back and realized, ooh, hey, one of those characters in my main story could be that hitman 5 or 6 years later. Like the artist drew it and it looked enough like that character. And I was like, hey, wait a minute. There's some connective tissue here. I can keep this guy in the same universe. And so I started picking where they landed. You know, my main story is in 1985. That story is in 1988. And I thought, oh, this could be fun. I could tell a story in 1981 about, the mentors of our lead characters when they were spies. So I did that because I had a couple of guys who I was like, oh, I throw them in there. They can be these two spies. And it made me create this whole story. And just these little things, these little islands popped up, and I started finding ways to link them all together. And it's fun to sort of tell these short takes. The artist, Chris Geary, who drew the Robin Hood graphic novel series that's kind of going on in tandem with Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll still, I had so much fun working with him on Robin Hood. I said, hey, I want to do a 5 or 6 page spy versus spy story, but with real spies, like the old Mad magazine Spy versus Spy, where there's no dialogue. It's just a man and a woman who are both spies going after the same target. And and it's like 6 pages, no dialogue. Here's the thing. And I gave him the outline and he drew it. I was like, oh my God, that's how much fun is that? That's crazy. So I threw that in there and it just sort of kept going and going from there. So I had no intention of making it an anthology, but when I did make it an anthology, what it became was, it's like this sort of incubator space to spin things off. And my main story, the main character's last name is Spade, Sam Spade. See, right. When I was a kid, I wasn't very creative. I was like, oh, Spade sounds like a cool last name, like a spy. So I did that. Very quickly, I have spun my original story off into a solo title. That's one of the separate books now.
Wow.
Because I wanted to keep the anthology strictly anthology. And the idea is that all of the stories in the anthology book are potentially spinoffs into their own titles if and when, that presents itself. And, and so it's like a baseball farm team, I guess, is the anthology book. And so it's allowed me to kind of, I can tell these stories in short chunks and create these characters and build an audience for these characters and then go, hey, you like that character? Here they are in a full length one shot adventure or miniseries. And cool. So I'm growing the universe out of the anthology book in some way. And I feel like maybe that was the way, back in the day, Adventure Comics at DC and some of these other series, that's the way they did it. That was the testing ground for getting your own title or characters that they wanted to use, but they didn't have enough oomph to kind of put them in their own book.
Right. Well, you can tell you're having way too much fun with this.
Oh my God. It's so much fun. I feel like I'm like 16 again with my little spiral bound notebook and my number 2 pencil just going to town.
So the third volume is coming.
Yes.
Is there a limit to the number you want to do, or do you want to just keep going until you decide, well, that's enough?
I have, I recently sat down in my head. I kind of had 10 as a number, and I recently sat down and sort of rough plotted my way through 10 anthology books between 64 and 80 pages a piece worth of stories, about 6, 7, 8 stories in each book. And so I've got enough ideas now that these things have kind of started taking a life of their own, that it will carry for 10 volumes. Cool. And the solo title that spun out, that was my original spy stuff, is a 10 issue miniseries. And I've got it all plotted out and figured out, but, there's another series right behind that I'm ready to tell. So it could be ongoing at a certain point. And I'm pretty confident now, just because that seems to be what's happening, is that by the time I get to like volume 6 or volume 7, I'll have enough new ideas to keep going past 10. You know, it just sort of keeps feeding itself. And, you know, I'll have enough of my friends who are writers and people who are artists who will come to me and go, hey, I want to do it. My cousin, who I grew up with, you know, he was my sounding board and all that stuff. He created some characters of his own at a certain point, you know, back in the day. And, you know, I kind of hit him up when I was doing this saying, hey, you know, that thing we used to goof around when we were kids talking about, I'm going to do it as a comic book. And did it and launched it, and he saw it, and I send him scripts, and he reads them, and he's, you know, gives me little pointers and stuff. So we've rekindled our relationship in a large extent. But some of his characters are going to get introduced in Volume 3, and there will be some stories based on those characters starting in Volume 4. So I'm kind of opening the doors. It's like if somebody comes to me and goes, I got an idea, let's figure out a way to fit it into your universe and let me tell a story, I'm all for it. Because there's a certain amount of, you know, people looking at the names on the books and going, well, what an ego this guy's got. He's writing everything. You know, I want it to be a playground for other people to come and join me. And so I'm starting to look for that. And I've met friends who are writers and publishers through Kickstarter and other platforms. And a couple of them I'm going to approach and say, hey, you know, come over and play. Come over, you know, come up with an 8-page story for my book and write it. And, you know, we'll just see where it goes from there. I'm all about creating a larger sort of community. And that's one of the things that Kickstarter reminds me of, a modern version of those old independent comics back in the 80s, where people were just like, I'm tired of playing the DC or Marvel game. I'm going to go over here and start an independent publishing company. And a lot of them didn't work out because printing and publishing back then was a lot harder than it is now. And comparatively more expensive, I'm sure. But you have the ability now. I think that the true modern independent comic book publishers are the ones who are crowdfunding. I think they're the ones who are finding their way to Kickstarter, finding their way to Zoop, which is fantastic. That those guys saw what I was doing and came to me and said, hey, you know, give us a try. And I love what they're building. Because it is sort of, it feels like these are the independent comic publishers of the modern day. And that's an exciting thing to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Very great. Again, it's Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll. And Jeff, it's been great fun talking with you. We'll have to do this again sometime when maybe something else is coming down the pike.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the Robin Hood book that we've been doing is we're working on the third volume of it now, and a publisher in England has picked it up, and they're starting to put it out in the UK. So we've got a couple more of those to do and more of these to do. As long as I'm not losing money, my wife is letting me keep this hobby going, and so hopefully I'll be doing it for a while.
What about TV at some point?
Well, you know, that's always the fantasy in the back of your head. I mean, when my cousin and I were kids and we were dreaming all this stuff up, one summer we created a board game out of poster board and stuff based on these characters. Like, we were just like, let's just, you know, we create a board game, and we played it. And I remember it functionally worked out pretty well. But then we would get bored and we would go, you know, take a trip to Disney one summer and then come back and go, we should do a spy theme park. And so we designed roller coasters and all this. So, you know, there's always that dream of, it's like, man, we want this to be as big as back then Star Wars or James Bond, or now as big as the Marvel movie universe. You know, people dream of that sort of stuff. But, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously it would be great. I think it would be a lot of fun to see it brought to life in different ways. And the anthology lends itself, you know, maybe there will be some TV or movie producer who goes, I like that one character in that one anthology story. Let's put him in a movie or whatever. And I would totally love that, but I'm not necessarily looking for it. I'm just having too much fun creating right now. And, you know, publishing my own stuff, working with Mike Grell, publishing some of his stuff. We just did a big hardcover collection of his John Sable freelance book from the 1980s, which was a big influence on me. And now I'm getting to work with, you know, one of my heroes helping him put out a collection. And I don't know. I just am living a kid in a candy shop kind of existence right now. Long as the bubble doesn't burst, whatever happens next happens next. I'm here for the ride.
Well, keep having fun because it really shines through. And I've had a chance to read them and I highly recommend them. And I haven't had a chance to read three yet, but I'm looking forward to that. So, Jeff, just keep up this wonderful stuff. And again, it's at zoop.gg and it's Sex, Spies, and Rock and Roll. And created by Jeff Douglas Messer, who is a pleasure to talk with.
Anyway, and I had a blast.
Much success with all this good stuff and other things. So I think it's going to be terrific.
Thank you so much. I look forward to staying in touch with you, and we'll talk to you again.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast. So you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time when we'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.